Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Education and Workforce Development.
Hey, welcome.
We are in a interim stage here, and it's customary for committee members to go down through the thing and introduce themselves and tell helpful things like what number their legislative district is, and so we're not going to do that today.
Yay!
But it is good to see all the men of the Senate Education Committee crew here.
We are.
And we have a guest from the House. Representative Johnson is here joining us today. And
thank
one
you.
Of the reasons he's here is that today we were putting forth and advancing a concept that essentially would allow Oregon high school graduates to go to Oregon community colleges at no charge. And we've been knocking around this idea for a while and working on it this summer, and we have some prominent experts and advocates of this idea signed up to come in and testify today. And one of them who signed up to come in and testify is Governor John Kitzhaber, MD. He is busy over at Mahoney Hall, so I don't know if he shows up or not. He's got a time certain date at 2:30. And to be quite honest with you, I think it's a good sign that he's still over there with the legislative leaders working on the grand bargain. Although, as he said on the phone the other day, this issue is frankly more significant than putting together some of the nuts and bolts of what we might work on in a special session. So the first thing we need to do before we get on to business is adopt our rules.
Okay.
And I trust you all have read the committee rules.
I have, Mr. Chair, and recognizing that, having read them, recognizing that two minority members can actually pass something is new to these rules, and I think that's exceptional. I appreciate you putting that in there. Okay, maybe it wasn't in there. Maybe I misread them. But, Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt the rules
really?
As written.
Did you get to do that in the Senate?
Senator, we don't need
it was worth a try.
That's what I thought.
Moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there discussion?
There's none.
Seeing none. Are there objections? Seeing none. The rules are adopted. So we have handed out this community college concept with some figures on it, some financial figures and what it might cost. And these are numbers that are extrapolated, difficult to quantify in many cases. And by no means are they the final numbers. These are probably one or two grades above back of the envelope figures. And but if on the high end, it might cost $250 million to put every Oregon high school graduate into a community college course full time, with the idea that they would be earning a two-year degree, or to become a welder or a medical assistant, or earning a certificate, or taking core classes through which they could easier transfer onto Portland State or one of our universities. So, and I think we have some copies of these in the back, along with some other news stories where some other places are trying this very idea in New York and I think in Tennessee as well. So why don't we start then with Bob Brew, the new interim executive director of the Oregon Student Access Commission. Bob, do you want to come up first? And do you want to bring up Elizabeth? Yeah, okay. Elizabeth Brand.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hyason, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Brew, and I'm the interim executive director for the Oregon Student Access Commission, sometimes known as OSAC. I'm here today with my colleague from Community Colleges and Workforce Development, Elizabeth Cox Brand, to give a little context to Senator Haas's proposal. When Senator Haas's office contacted us a couple weeks ago, we were asked to come up with some rough figures on what a plan would cost to enable every graduating senior with a cumulative GPA of 3.0 or above to take a core set of classes at a community college over 2 years. After some rough calculations, here's what we reported. Based on 2011-2012 data, the most recent data available, about 32,000 students received a high school diploma within 4 years. And according to Brian Reeder of the Oregon Department of Education, about 54% of those had a final GPA of 3.0 or better. That means that at the upper limit, roughly 17,280 students would be eligible for the program each year. The number of classes or the number of credits to be earned hasn't been fully decided yet. So as a proxy, we just used what it would take to obtain an Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree, or an AAOT. This is the core classwork a student would acquire if they planned to transfer to a four-year public university after 2 years. In order to earn an AAOT degree, a student would need to acquire 90 total credits, or an average of about 15 credits per term. At an average cost per credit of $85.94, that totals about $7,735 per student. This cost is the same for virtually any community college credit, so if you are considering what it would cost for a student to earn a 90-credit certificate or an associate degree, the cost would be about the same. For 17,280 students to start and complete the program, the total cost would be about $133,654,000. The biennial cost would be more because the second year a new crop of high school graduates would join the rank, and at full implementation, the total cost would be about $267,300,000 per biennium. Of course, that's the complete upper limit and assumes that every student participates fully and takes the full load and stays the full time. We know some students wouldn't attend community college, even if it was free, since they might have a scholarship somewhere else, they don't live near a community college, or they don't want to go to college at all. We just don't know how many that is. We can also assume that many of the students would qualify for Pell Grants and the Oregon Opportunity Grant or other types of financial aid. Again, we just don't know how many, but this would obviously bring the cost down. If the program funds fewer than 90 hours, or if a student takes a course of study that requires less than 90 hours, the total price tag would go down. On the potential cost increase side, we did assume that tuition would remain constant, and it probably won't. Also, most community colleges are at or near capacity, and such a large influx of students may require increases in capital investment or staffing. Again, these are very much back-of-the-envelope kinds of calculations, and as this plan progresses, we'll be glad to work with others to firm up some of our assumptions and tighten up the calculations. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'd turn the microphone over to Elizabeth.
Okay, we'll hold our questions until she's finished.
Thank you, Senator Haas. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Cox Brand. I'm the Director of Research and Communications for the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Agency. I'm here today to provide a little more context about investing in our community colleges in Oregon. Our community colleges are key access points for Oregonians seeking post-secondary education. In 2011-12, Oregon community colleges served over 123,000 credit students, and of those, almost 95% are Oregonians. Oregon community colleges are the heart and soul of our state's 40-40-20 goal, and they serve as the primary source for the components of the Middle 40, which is the associate's degree or certificates. The Middle 40 is not only the center of the educational goal, but the products of it are also extremely important to Oregon's economy. According to the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, by 2020, 37% of Oregon jobs will require some college, an associate's degree, or a certificate. Oregon community colleges really are a sound investment. Recently, Economic Modeling Specialists International completed a study examining the economic contributions of Oregon's community colleges. Among their key findings were Oregon Community College, they benefit students as students are able to recover all of their costs of their education within 7 years. They also provide social benefits. The annual benefit to Oregon due to community colleges is $693 million in the form of higher earnings and increased property income, as well as an additional $33 million in reduced costs. in the way of lower crime rates and reduced income assistance. And Oregon taxpayers also see a return on the investment that they make in your community colleges. For every $1 that's invested, Oregon taxpayers receive $2.20 in return in added tax revenue and avoided costs to government, again with health, income assistance, and crime. In closing, Oregon community colleges are a key component for what's coming next for Oregon. We enrich the lives of our students, we increase students' lifetime incomes, generate government income and revenue, reduce the demand for social services, and contribute to the growth of the state and local economies. I'd be happy to take any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you both. Can you give us a sense of the high school students, graduates, otherwise, who don't go on to higher education or community college training, what then does happen to them?
Senator Haas, I can give you some anecdotes. I don't have any data to support it, but students may go into the military. They may move out of state, and we don't necessarily know what may happen to them. We can find some of them if they enroll in college, and we're working on some data matching to see if they're employed in other states. But there's a variety of different things that they could go into, including the workforce.
Mm-hmm. So the overall benefits that you see, public benefits outweigh the public costs, mm-hmm. In a way that, how would you characterize that, or how would you spell it out besides just those numbers that you put it on?
Senator Haas, there's been a lot of research that shows that students or citizens who are educated have lower health costs, are more engaged citizens. Their children do better in their educational trajectory. The poverty levels are lower. The literacy rates are higher. It overall just leads to a better state for everyone, better communities.
And at the same time, given that their earnings potential is higher, they generate more property tax revenues for local governments and school districts, more income tax revenue for state government. They're more likely to start businesses. And so that the rising tide raises all boats. As we're able to educate more of our students, it helps the state as a whole.
Other questions?
Representative Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elizabeth, I don't know that you're the expert on this for CCWD, but what about the physical constraints of being able to actually provide the space necessary for this influx of students? And obviously we're dealing in hypotheticals here. We don't know how many would take advantage of this and how many would not, but obviously there would need to be some significant upgrading of our facilities, I'm guessing, to be able to even I don't know how to ask the question, but can you envision a process of being able to physically ramp up? And obviously the state's going to have to invest in a lot of other bricks and mortar and things to make this even attainable. So,
Senator Haas, Representative Johnson, we were talking about that, actually. The community colleges, we received 16 of our capital construction projects mm-hmm. were funded, and we're very grateful for that. It's much needed. But as Bob and I were preparing for this testimony, we were talking about what would that mean to have that many more students actually in our community colleges. Our enrollment is down slightly, which is good because that means the economy is improving. But we are still at record levels. So in order for us to get more students in the door, if it were into our classrooms, we would need a lot more support in capital construction and improvements and upgrading.
Just a follow-up on that question. How many students now annually enroll in community colleges?
Senator Haas, Senator Roblin, for our community colleges, for credit students, it's over 123,000 students.
But that's credit. Is that full-time students, or is that done by credit hours?
That's full-time equivalent student. So the headcount is higher than that. The bodies are higher than
that. That's what I was thinking, yeah. So because you're talking here 31,000 kids. That's, if you've got 100,000 now and some of them are going out, that's what I'm trying to figure out. How much more room do we really need? Because that sounds like it's more than there are kids coming in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it could be up to like 2,000 for different community colleges if you look at it that way. And for some of them, that may not be a big deal. For some of them, that may be a bigger deal. They're all very different in their capacities.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you had the opportunity to look historically back to when California had a similar program? Their junior college system used to be free,
right.
And yet they still had robust enrollment in their state universities in the UC system. I wonder if there's a sort of a proportional comparison we might look at that.
Chairman Haas, Senator Beyer, we have not had a chance to look at that. I think that as this goes forward, we will look at that system more closely, because I think there's some good lessons in their program that we could learn from. Thank you.
That's a great point, and I've had people anecdotally tell me that they went through the California system back in the 60s, and it was sort of the crown jewel of education in the world, and probably responsible for the creation of the Silicon Valley, and before that, the Sputnik generation. Okay. Well, we thank you for your work, and I know that we're going to be in communication and contact with you as we move forward.
It's a great idea.
Thank you. Brian Fox. Here?
Yes.
Brian is with OUS and has been looking into this return on investment issue that Elizabeth Cox Brand brought up.
In this, I fear much of what was discussed earlier I'll end up echoing, but hopefully with some numbers behind it. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knott, members of the committee, honored guest, I appreciate your opportunity to talk about the Education PACE report that I put together at the request of Vice Chancellor Kenton. This is modeled after a national report, the Education PACE report, put together by Sandy Baum and
Brian, start off with your name and ID.
Yeah, I apologize. For the record, my name is Brian Fox. I'm a research assistant with the Oregon University System. So the Education PACE report is modeled after the College Board puts together this report at a national level using census data. And with that, I was able to drive down to state-level information and then use cost use cost information provided by the university system, CCWD, the Department of Ed, and Legislative Fiscal. When you go into it, I guess let's just start off here. It's worth looking at what are our costs to educate a student. These are sort of rough numbers where you take aggregate appropriations, both federal, state, and local, and divide that by the degree outcomes that we get. So this is, if you have students that stop out of the system, you're going to lose numbers off the denominator. It's going to boost your cost up higher. And so you see that play out in certain of these areas that are higher than you'd expect. And you also see sort of years of embedded cost. In the K-12 side, you have 12 years of embedded cost to one degree. So naturally, you're going to see a higher expense. Same with higher ed or the OUS system, where you see, you know, 4 years or more. So there's a rough estimate of where your costs look like. But then you move over to what are the outcomes that you get. And I think this is the important part, both for individuals and for the state. So the top number is your average expected income broken down by your educational attainment level. On the far left-hand side, people who stop out of the high schools or stop out of the K-12 system, and then growing asymptotically into advanced degrees, where you see significant income returns well above median wages, and these are all Oregon figures. The red bar on the top are federal tax dollars, federal taxes that a person at that income level will be paying. The green bars are state and local taxes. And you see those bars grow as incomes grow, and that's the nature of a progressive tax system. What you also see is that at the bottom levels, there's really a de minimis amount of return that comes in. So the second question is, okay, here you have tax returns to the state after an investment in education, and then you also have investments that are made in the criminal justice system or in social safety net programs, and those will come up next. I guess these will come up in a second. Here I have attachment to the labor force, and these are really cherry-picked statistics out of this report. I have literally dozens more slides that show this same relationship. On the big box on the far left-hand side, you see unemployment rates. This is 2009 through 2011, so really deep in the rut of the last recession. And you see, you know, significant unemployment rates for folks that stopped out of high school, even for folks that graduated from high school or some college. But as you move to advanced degrees, you have very little unemployment, even in the depths of the recession. Also, as importantly, and kind of, I think, underappreciated or underlooked at, in the upper right-hand box, that's labor force non-participation rate. So those individuals in that box are ones that aren't participating in any way in the labor force. They don't have a job. They're not looking for a job. Either they're supporting themselves or they're being supported through social safety net programs. And again, you see that relationship where once you move up the degree spectrum into advanced degrees, you have very few folks that are sort of in that sector. Now moving on to social safety net programs, and like I said, there's literally a half a dozen or more slides going from food stamps to Medicaid to SSI and Social Security benefits, where you see this decelerating or negative relationship between educational attainment and utilization of social safety net programs. And to another one that has a significant cost burden both at the state and federal levels on Medicaid, the blue line are individuals who have private health insurance coverage, and the red line are individuals that are on Medicaid. That's a direct cost to the state, and again, you see this very close relationship with educational attainment levels. And here is the cost, the sort of direct cost and return to the state, both through tax dollars or in savings from social safety net programs and from incarceration. And you see that until you get to the bachelor's degree level, you have a negative return. But what's most important to look at is, as folks making investment choices know, is the marginal cost and the marginal return at each level, and to ignore the sunk costs that are already embedded. And so as soon as you move beyond the high school diploma into the community colleges, every dollar you're putting in there, you're getting much more back from those individuals. Even if they stop out before they complete an associate's degree, mm-hmm. You can see the economic benefit to even 1 year of college or 3 years of college and no degree. And then once again, you see that accelerating growth at the top end with advanced degrees, where those individuals seem to drive the economic returns to the state. And this, I think, is, to me, one of the most important things is you can really view the intergenerational nature of the problem that we confront with individuals that stop or drop out of education and with those that we push farther on. These are graphs of school readiness for children age 3 to 5 and then for children in the 5th grade based on their parents' educational attainment level. And you see this tight relationship between the investment that parents who are educated and well-educated make in their children and how ready they are when they enter the educational pipeline. And then you can see this relationship between how prepared they are when they start school to where they are when they finish and where they continue on. So really the investments that we can make in educational attainment for parents for one generation will pay off over time. And I think that feeds to the discussion earlier about California as the crown jewel of education. They structured education at the community college, at the state system, and the UC level so that students had an opportunity, no excuses, to get higher ed if they had the ability to do it. And because of that, you saw one of the strongest, most robust economies in the nation. Washington made a similar investment. And again, you've seen that return both in per capita income levels and in reduced dependence on state support programs in those areas. And then the other question is, what do we want as a society? And the decisions that you make as policy makers and as appropriators, really, they shine through in amazing areas. This is volunteer hours on an annual basis. You'll find similar graphs for voting, for obesity rates. If you give people the information, you make the opportunities available to them to reach higher educational attainment. Then they'll move on and be better citizens. They'll give back to our communities, and that aids the state and the individuals in the long run. I think, as I look at what the state spends its money on, there are really three distinct areas. You've got education, you have public safety, and you have social safety net programs. The latter two is money spent on failures, right? It's money spent on people who, for whatever reason, are unable to support themselves, and money spent on individuals who act in antisocial ways. But that third area, the education side, is an area where you can make investments that break that cycle of underperformance will reduce the cost to the state in the long term, but will increase individual self-worth, will make this a better place to live. It's a costly investment, and it's hard to do when you have other areas that are pushing hard. But it's one that if you want to look in the long term and how you shape the society, education is the place that you can do it. And I'm happy to, I think that's the end of this presentation. I'm happy to forward the full report to each of you and spend time individually going through it or to answer any of your questions here.
Well, we could probably spend an entire hearing on each one of those slides. Particularly interesting to me was the one that pays off benefits to your kids. Really generational savings. Questions? And you'll forward that report on to us.
Yeah, I'll forward the full report on to you.
It's really enlightening. I think most of it's probably intuitive, but until you see it documented about, you know, volunteer time and the costs that educated folks are not incurring in our social system. Okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Ben Cannon is here subbing in for the negotiating boss down the street. Thank you very much for coming in and addressing this subject. I know you have some feelings on it, and the governor does too, of interest to us. In addition to what we just heard on the return on investment is getting down to brass tacks, how we would pay for some of this. And I know we've been discussing possibilities, including waivers on the Pell Grant. And so appreciate your help.
Thank you, Senator Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Governor's Education Policy Advisor. I'm afraid I've been put in the worst possible position today of having to sub for the governor, and I cannot do justice to the remarks that he would make, but I do have some sense of what those would be. So I will do my best, and I'll address a couple of the points that you raised, Senator Haas. So feel free to stop me. I have maybe 5 or 10 minutes here. So the governor first wanted to express his support for the concept that Senator Haas has made the subject of today's hearing, and that could be a sort of 2014 legislation that could lead to 2015 enactment of a promise of free community college to Oregonians. And I think for the governor, what is particularly exciting and appealing about this idea, and it's one that he talked about during his 2010 campaign, was the idea of the power of a promise to students, a promise of access and affordability. What's very clear is that the combination of rising tuition fees and cost of living has meant that too few Oregon high school students see post-secondary education as a viable option. And even for those who do manage to sort of claw their way into enrolling in a community college or university, the high cost causes many of them, too many of them, probably, to attend part-time, to suspend their efforts partway through, or to accumulate a daunting level of long-term debt. And so the governor would encourage you to think about community college affordability not merely as a problem of access to the system, which it is, but also as a problem for productivity within the system. Students who take longer to complete a degree, who are more likely to drop out or enroll part-time, are also increasing the cost associated with cost to the state of their educations and reducing our return on investment. We've been raising the bar for K-12, right? And we have a new, more rigorous high school diploma. And it's time, in the governor's view, to do more than raise that bar, but to create a handshake with students over the top of it. And to say, essentially, if you satisfy these more rigorous requirements for high school graduation, we're going to ensure that college is available and affordable to you. And if we can get that promise right, if we can make that promise real and believable, then the governor believes it could unleash a tremendous amount of motivation within young people today. And when we think about where the resources for 40-40-20 are going to come from, and that's sort of the elephant in the room around this, yes, it's a problem of our financial wherewithal, but it's also a problem of unlocking resources that are within the young people of this state. And one of the ways to do that is to create this real, meaningful, believable, sustainable promise of affordable higher education. So that's why the governor is excited about exploring this concept with you over the next 18 to 24 months. So he did want to establish a few principles that, in his view, should help sort of guide and shape this work over the next couple of years. And so I'm going to run through those now. First, whatever we do in this regard, it needs to be sustainable. We've got to ensure that whatever policy we create is adaptable to fluctuations in resources and politics without violating the core promise. And we've certainly had enough experience with high aspirations, a sort of sense of commitment that then gets, I won't say reneged or violated, but gets rolled back. And that is something we have to avoid. Secondly, the resources that we apply to this should be focused on programs and degrees that will get us to 40-40-20 equitably. This really has to be understood, and I think the senator's alluded to this and sort of how he has envisioned targeting this program. But not all community college courses are alike, and we should prioritize those that are most closely associated with our state goals. We've got to ensure, so now thirdly, we should ensure that whatever incentives we use here to motivate students, we don't turn our back on incentives that also incentives for colleges to help support them towards completion. So there's been a lot of work done over the last year moving towards the State Board of Education or potentially the HEC to create incentives for colleges to really focus not merely on enrolling students, but to support them to completion. And that it's important to the governor not to lose that that work. Fourth, some local flexibility needs to be maintained. There's a risk here that the state comes up with a scheme, imposes it on the colleges, and their abilities to match their programs and their priorities with the needs of their communities, which colleges are well designed to do, gets minimized. Fifth, we have to have some way of controlling costs, the cost side of the equation for colleges. So as the state takes on more responsibility for funding access and completion, as is suggested here, we have to redouble our efforts to control institutional costs. Free should not imply a blank check for the state, from the state. Sixth, our modeling must account for the full costs to students. So I think oftentimes when, as policymakers, we think of the cost of higher education, we take into consideration tuition, fees, et cetera. Of course, from a student standpoint, that, especially at the community college level, is perhaps even the smaller piece of the equation. The larger piece of the equation is the living costs associated with, you know, not working for at least a portion of their time and attending classes instead. That isn't to say that this program needs to directly subsidize those living costs, but when we think about how students have skin in the game, which I can imagine being a concern of a promise of free community college, free tuition at community college, let's understand here that students are, of course, typically having to find a way to pay for the basic costs of living. And so our modeling needs to take into account those full costs. The last two, one of them to address something that Senator Haass suggested, the program design should maximize federal funding. In one community college district alone, federal Pell Grants bring in $11 million annually. Absent a change in Pell Grant formulas, we could find ourselves simply replacing federal dollars, Pell Grants, with state dollars, buying down the cost of tuition to free. We'll need to partner with the feds to ensure that there's flexibility to ensure that these dollars aren't left on the table. And so one can imagine a variety of ways in which we would continue to take advantage of those federal dollars while creating that promise of free. And then finally, as we consider this proposal, it's important to compare its impact on outcomes with other similarly sized investments that the state could make. Ultimately, our decision here about whether or not to go forward with this needs to be measured against what other impact could we have on 40-40-20 by making a similarly sized investment? So, for example, would putting the same amount of money that is contemplated here into the Oregon Opportunity Grant instead produce a better outcome? And that is the type of analysis that should drive the ultimate decision making on this. Clearly, to do this would take significant resources, probably in the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars per biennium. And as we think about that, let's recognize that students and their families are paying more for higher education now and going into debt more than ever before. The state has not been matching those efforts when it comes to higher education. That student and family effort should be matched by the state. Let's also understand that to make these investments will underscores the importance of making of broader efforts around holding down healthcare costs, public safety costs, stabilizing our revenue system, and dealing with costs in our retirement system. That obviously is work before you as early as later this month, and the governor would like to remind you of your opportunities in that regard.
Gee, what's he referring to?
Final thing I think the governor was struck, as many of you were, by the level of national attention that was generated by the pay-forward proposal that the legislature generated this year. And he is increasingly convinced that we can't deal with the issue of college affordability merely incrementally, that whether it's through advancing the pay-forward concept, the Treasurer's Oregon Opportunity Initiative, some combination of those two, or the concept of free community college that's on the table here today, we do need to take bold steps over the next 2 to 4 years to convince many more Oregonians that higher education is in their future. The future of 40-40-20 certainly depends on it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate those comments, even your little editorial about the pending special session possibility. We discussed this notion of skin in the game, and I'm concerned about that too. I do think if the students should achieve some responsibility by something, whether it's a copay, $100 a term, or a work study, or what do you think might constitute skin in the game, aside from the usual sideboards, like you have to have decent grades, you have to attend these classes, and all of those things?
Senator Haas, members of the committee, it's a good question. I don't have a particularly good answer to it, except to reinforce the point I made relative to the actual cost of attendance, which is much more than tuition. And, in fact, I mean, at many community colleges, my understanding is that a low-income student who qualifies for Pell Grants and potentially state need-based financial aid is able to buy down the cost of, through those, is able to reduce the tuition cost to very near zero already. That doesn't mean that the barriers are not still significant, because if you're talking about full-time enrollment, you're talking about a very part-time job being sort of the maximum that you can pull off, and you're talking about significant living expenses still that need to be covered. And so that, to me, constitutes pretty significant skin in the game, even at zero cost tuition. So I just would encourage the committee to use that frame. That said, I think, you know, this is partly going to be a matter of politics, too, and selling this to a public who I think is very reasonably going to say, well, free, we're not so sure, because where is that sort of student contribution? Maybe it is $100. Maybe it's just reinforcing the point I'm making around the cost, other costs of attendance. But it's clearly something we're going to have to spend some time thinking about.
Yeah, and in convincing the public, Brian Goh, just bring him around everywhere and show him those graphs and say, you know, it's pretty expensive to subsidize someone's health care needs and to subsidize their social welfare system, too. In fact, it's more expensive to do that. And the budgets we pass around here are to, what did he say, that the money spent on failure. There's a lot of that, mm-hmm. corrections and Medicaid and some of those things. So that's That's a difficult equation, really, to talk about. It's difficult to it's getting easier to quantify, but it's very real. Other questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, I appreciate your short notice, and you did a good job. You had all 8 points in, plus the little plug there as well. Nice job. But I do think, you know, we have to acknowledge that I think we have a history in Oregon of launching out on these bold initiatives that make good headlines and sound bites for a day or two, but then are they sustainable? And that's the I think I appreciate yours and or the governor's emphasis on that. But we have, you know, we've launched out in some other bold initiatives here that, again, we're still grappling with how we're going to pay for all day K. You know, the bill for that's going to come due in a few short years, and we still, to my knowledge, don't have a good way to pay for that yet. So I do think, I mean, we need a comprehensive discussion about, especially in the P20 environment, you know, we can't put undue resources in one other area at the expense of the other, because I think we all would agree that all day K is a worthy investment. It certainly has been in my district. But potentially investing more money in some areas may allow us to find efficiencies in others. And I don't know whether you're equipped to answer this or not, but I don't know what percentage of the Oregon Opportunity Grant goes to community college students now. And if, in fact, some of that could be redirected in another area, or if it was just simply directed towards university students, what impact might that have on completion too? You know, those are other questions we need to examine as you look at this whole scenario. So I appreciate what you brought today.
Any questions? Okay. Thanks. Thank you. All right. To be continued. We're going to move next into sort of an informational hearing on some of the strategic investment laws that were passed in the last session. And so why don't I start with Nancy Golden, the new interim chief education officer, and her team, if you want to come up first.
Yes.
And first of all, welcome to the new job. We've seen you before.
Right.
In a similar capacity.
Thank you. Senator Haas, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, and I'm the interim chief education officer. I want to do a bit of an overview, and then we'll have other members of the team talk about our strategic investments. The Oregon Education Investment Board has three major jobs after you pass the legislation to create the P20 system. Our first job is to develop it and support it. Our second job is to manage the transitions and to break down the barriers that we find along the pathway. And the third one is to recommend investments to the governor for his budget and to legislators. Of course, all of this we do because we want children at a very young age, actually at birth, to successfully start moving along the pathway. And what we know is that some of the early targets, like coming to kindergarten ready to learn, helps leverage them much more successfully to every other target that we have in our achievement compact. So I want to go over a few things we are doing to deliver on our three big responsibilities. Of course, we look at all of this through an equity lens. That's very critical to us, and the OEIB board did pass an equity lens framework. So talking about the seamless system, one of the things we've put in place is a P20 internal group, and that is really the executive directors from all these organizations on the continuum. So this would be Jada Ripley from Early Education. It would be Rob Saxon from ODE, Gerald Hamilton from Workforce and Community College, Melody Rose from OUS, Bob Rue, who just spoke to you, and the OEIB staff. The purpose of us meeting is to say, how do we make this seamless? How do we break down barriers? And we're talking about some very important issues that are really related to what you're talking about. One of our first conversations was about 12th grade and how do we make sure students have full schedules. And making sure they have full schedules, couldn't they gain a lot of at least their beginning of college in high school? So we're really working together. We think that's a really important structure. The second is a business case, which we will owe to you, the legislators, in this upcoming session, the longitudinal database, so we do have data that really helps us look at our investments and see if they're working. I want you to know that Eugene School District was nice enough to loan us Peter Trumba. He's sitting back here. He will be the person who will deliver the longitudinal database case to you. Peter built a computer. I think he was 10 when he did it. He programmed routers. He's been a technology director in two school districts. But in addition to that, he was a high school principal, I think, when Senator Roblin, you were a high school principal. And he also was a middle school principal. So he brings the technical knowledge, and he also brings the expertise in the field. And we're very pleased to have him with us because that longitudinal database is important. The second piece is focusing on those transitions, and we are working very closely together. So the Early Learning Division and ODE, we're really working on that smooth transition so students come to kindergarten ready to learn. I have to say the last time I worked here in 2011 and I started hearing about this, I had to reflect on myself as a superintendent and said I really haven't reached out to like Head Start or other organizations like I should have. And I put that out, and before I could get to them, Head Start reached out to me, and I had a profound experience that day because I went to visit. They showed me their curriculum. They showed me portfolios for three-year-olds, and it doesn't get any cuter than portfolios for three-year-olds. They took me in the classroom, and they showed me how they coach teachers to do the best by these kids. And it wasn't until I left that I realized everyone with me was a parent. There wasn't one paid person there, and I went back to the district and said, we can do much better with how we use our parent volunteers because I just saw it done in a way I never could imagine. That's just one small example of when you work across the pathways, the opportunity it brings, not only at that level, but for every other level. Of course, the other transition that's critical to us is the transition what we've referred to as 11 through 14. In the Accelerated Learning Task Force, which was a bill that came out of the Senate, I'm very excited that I am directly involved in that. We know, I have seen children, young adults, who get credits in high school, and because they have them, they begin to think they could go to college. And without obtaining those in high schools, they wouldn't think that college was a reality for them. And once they get 20 credits, some students get much more, they're able to really say, I am going to go to college and I'm going to graduate from college. So that transition is key. You've already been talking about it today. The last thing is the investments and making sure we look at the investments and we look at whether the investments are working. Of course, the OEIB, the legislators passed the achievement compacts, which have key targets along the way. So one thing we will be doing is analyzing the targets along the pathway to make sure we're meeting our targets. Once we know, when we aggregate up, we can say what target's hardest to meet, and we can start really then deciding what do we need to do to get to the target. So we will start doing an analysis. We have hired a policy and research person. I think many of you know him. He was a legislator, David Edwards. We're very pleased to be bringing him on because we know he has the skill to really provide to you the research you need to know if the P20 system is really working, if we're getting a return on our investments. Well, so with that, I'll stop and see if there's questions so the rest of the team can talk to you about key initiatives.
Questions of Dr. Golden in her new role. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Thank
to you.
You.
And we have a full slate of prominent educators here, and I'm not sure who wants to go next. We're talking about the 3200 series. Deputy Director Saxton, did you want to kick that off?
Yes, please.
Your team. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. An honored guest, I believe, is the right terminology. Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, and have with me Jada Rupley and also Iris Bell, who are going to talk a little bit about one of the pieces that we have going on that Nancy referred to. She talked a really big, about some really big picture items. I'm going to talk about a couple of real specific things that we have going on, and then we'll continue that with some about some of the investments that we have underway. So today what I wanted to talk about just real briefly is the two bills that were passed out of the last session, House Bill 3234, which brought the Early Learning Division into the Department of Education, and also House Bill 3231, which brought the Youth Development Division into the Department of Education. I'm going to let obviously Jod and Iris talk a little bit about their component pieces of that. For the Department of Education, this is something that we began working on early last year in anticipation that there was a possibility that these bills would be passed in order to make sure that we stood at the ready to have as smooth a transition in as possible so that we begin to get the services to students in a different way. Nancy talked about the effort to smooth out some of the transition pieces, and certainly the department now has smoothed out some of those transition pieces depending on which end of the spectrum that you want to talk about, but really from P through 12 at this point in time is where the department stands with tentacles, obviously, on into 20. So a couple things that we're able to accomplish with this are streamlining of some of the back office function that these three organizations previously have all had to support for themselves, like procurement, HR, payroll, assessment, and myriad other parts. And then I think the duty that we have is to ensure that what we deliver across the state is greater than the sum of our collective parts, so that when we bring these together, that the delivery to students and children across the state is greater than it would have been otherwise. And so with a couple of examples around that, I know that Jada and Iris have a couple of those, and I'll turn it over to Jada with your permission.
Thank you, Rob. Chair Haas, committee members, my name is Jada Rupley. I'm the Early Learning System Director. Thank you very much for including early learning on your agenda today. I joined the Governor's Office a year ago as the Early Learning System Director, and we've had a busy year. As Rob said earlier, what we have done is we have done significant amount of internal and external work in the early learning. When I started with Oregon a year ago, you had passed landmark legislation in terms of changing the education, both with Senate Bill 909 as well as House Bill 4165, which was the early learning version of educational change. I want to use one example of why we think the Department of Education, along with the early learning, are good together. And if you look at your folders that I have in front of you, there's an example with kindergarten assessment. And the very top page looks like this. And I want to do this as a brief example because I know time is limited and you have many of us on your agenda. If you look at kindergarten assessment, House Bill 4165 directed the Early Learning Council to create an early learning kindergarten assessment. It was supposed to be jointly developed with the Department of Education. So if you look at this, you see that in 2012, the Early Learning Council and the department began jointly developing this process. It was adopted by the Early Learning Council as a tool. It was then piloted in 16 schools in 13 districts and covered 1,200 kindergartners. The State Board of Education then had to implement changes in rules to be able to implement this in schools, and this fall, you have rolled out a kindergarten assessment across the state of Oregon for all kindergartners. So we think this is one of those perfect examples of working together that turn around and change the business of schools and the work that we're doing. I think at this point what I'd like to do is refer on to Iris, because I know, like I said, there are many. Any questions that any of the committee members might have?
Since we're on early learning, you've no doubt heard some turbulence about the application process in some of these, and I just wanted to ask on the record, because we've had some constituents and some other members come to us and say, hey, what's going on? And some of the counties are having difficulty with their application process, and this may be just a growing pain or a starting pain, and it feels like that, but can you address that in terms of whether that's working as well as intended, or can it be fixed, or what the situation is?
Chair Haas, committee members, I'd be glad to address that because we are in the midst of that change right now. We have rolled out the application, and the application is for an open competitive application. You, in your legislation, looked at over the next biennium 16 new early learning hubs. We would look at up to 7 in year one, and then the second round up to the other 9 in by 2014. Counties have been the recipients of those Commission for Children and Family dollars up until then, and so what we are in right now with counties is that transition time between now and when we have hubs fully implemented. I think that from my perspective, and I hope that you understand that also, is that what we did not do is we did not disrupt any services to children or families in this process. And we appreciate the fact that in the process, the commission staff were eliminated as part of the legislation in 4165. However, we did give $20,000 to every county to be able to help us with the measurement of outcomes as well as managing those contracts. So I think probably right now it's the worst time. I feel that we have a good application moving out. We've been out around the state in communities trying to address some of those issues specifically with county commissioners, but the system will look different in the next year's time.
Could you give us a look at what the system should look like? I mean, kind of paint a picture for us, the perfect world in one of these hubs, the application goes through, everybody's happy. What does that look like?
The one thing that we did not do is we did not create a cookie-cutter approach, because as soon as you do that from Salem, what we know in the communities that you serve will not be applicable in many ways that we might create. So if you look in your packet, I do have an infographic to talk about that. And probably the most important thing is that communities, what we would consider ready for some of those first rounds are that they have all people at the table, and there are 5 sectors. It works all the way from the healthcare, so that could include their primary care providers. It would include the CCOs in some way, shape, or form. It looks at early learning providers, so those child care providers, those Head Start, home visiting, all of those elements, as well at the end as they have their school districts involved, because one of the things that we know is if we're going to change the dial on kindergarten readiness, we have to be able to look at that as a full continuum.
Okay, and it's my understanding that counties can opt out if they want.
Yes, sir.
What does that then limit them to? How is it that they are allowed to opt out? Does that mean they just don't get the money? They don't, their constituents don't have these services? Or what does that mean?
Chair Haas, committee members, that I think that's probably part of the system change. Is previously we had a county system where all services were delivered through counties. In the new hub system, you may end up with a more regional type approach. You could end up with new hub elements that are not delivered by counties.
Okay. Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot like this, but
it's okay.
That's your job, and we're getting these questions. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Senator Hess's earlier question, and this may be more for you, Rob, but it influences both of you, or it has to deal with both of you, but in this new era of strategic investments and so forth, you know, you've got a pool of money that's being disseminated out there and so forth, which requires at the local level, school district level, a lot of RFP responses or forms need to be filled out. One of the dynamics that I'm hearing about, and maybe you have already too, is that school districts do not, many of them just simply aren't large enough to have the personnel on board to negotiate that process, because it can be quite time consuming, as you well know. We're fortunate we happen to have access to a really good grant writer in Hood River, but we're going to have to really pick and choose those because, as I said, they're incredibly time consuming. So, but some districts, you know, are at the lower level, smaller districts, just don't have personnel now, as you well know, at the end of all of these reductions and cuts we've made over the last several years. So I'm just wondering if you thought about that and a way to kind of mitigate that.
Yeah.
because I think you'll hear a lot more about it in the days to come if you haven't already.
Right, right. Chair Haas, Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. It's a really great question. It's one that we've been very concerned about at the department, especially in our effort to make sure that we get funds out as quickly as we possibly can to get traction on these investments and these changes as quickly as possible. And so one of the things that we have done is we took $1 million of the dollars that were set aside, and we have those specifically to hire up grant writers through the ESD system. Okay. And so ESDs, especially in the rural counties, have gotten $40,000 right now so they can go out and hire a grant writer who can work with some of them, our more rural districts, around that issue. We also found that some of the ESDs and or cooperatives of districts have come together and said, we think that our application will be stronger if we, in this application, if we coalesce around whatever it happened to be, like mentors mm-hmm. and so forth. And so we've had coalitions of 6, 8, 10 school districts come together and write these grant applications and pool their resources to get that done. So that, like with the mentor grant, is one that is fresh in my mind because we, just got that out the door, where we had lots of that kind of work taking place. And those are a couple different ways to get at that.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. Other questions? Okay.
Move on. My turn. Chair Haas, representatives of the committee, Representative Johnson. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the director of the Youth Development Council. As you know, the council was developed and established out of House Bill 4165 to support the Oregon Education Investment Board. And now, with House Bill 4231, we have moved over to the Department of Education. And we have moved over to the Department of Education, where we have now a division of the Department of Education. That transition, and you know, there have been several transitions here. Our first transition, as Jada mentioned earlier, was out of the old commission system into the governor's office, where the Youth Development Council was established, and now we're transitioning once again over to the Department of Ed and to become a division there. We have, in terms of that transition, began sitting on Dr. Saxon's management team and engaging in conversations with respect to youth and youth issues and working with several of the divisions that already exist within the department. For example, within the department right now, there's a homeless youth education division. And as you know, in the old commission system, there was the Homeless and Runaway Youth Committee, which is now over at DHS. Well, we're sitting now looking at how do we get that continuity and alignment of those kinds of systems in order to support young people. And these particular young people, these homeless youth, are showing up at school. They're actually making the effort to show up at school every day. And we're looking at, okay, how can we ensure the support across systems and across agencies for these young people who are desperately trying to ensure that they get their education. And so one of these major transition pieces, which I think is just a gem, is that we are coming together across the divisions to have those conversations, which means over at the Department of Ed, where you have your homeless youth education program, they have liaisons out in the field. Over at the Department of Human Services, they have 8 sites that support homeless youth across the state. And so with the conversations we're having now and those folks coming together, we're beginning to take a look at how we can best support those young people. And that really is the goal of the Youth Development Council, to support young people 6 to 20 across a continuum with respect to academic supports, the reduction of juvenile crime, and with respect to career development. And so this is the work that we're engaged in doing as we move forward. In your little packet that I sort of handed out to you, it talks about how we are going to further the goals of the agency, but also further the goals of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and we are going to also be out in the field based on your legislative direction to gain information from parents, stakeholders with respect to providers, school districts, educators, to get a sense of how we should plan going forward. As you may know, our planning, as Jada also said, our planning and our funding this year continues to go to communities to provide the services in a seamless way for one more year. So our particular funding and our particular programs that we would necessarily plan to fund in the future won't really go into effect until 2014. So in the meantime, we are continuing to fund and ensure that services in communities are provided to communities while we engage those communities in conversations going forward about what we might fund and how we might give support to those particular communities. One thing I might say is that in the conversation that happened earlier with respect to the PowerPoint presentation, there was a question about what about those youth who are not engaged in school or not planning to go on in terms of higher education. Well, there's a conversation going on across the country right now, particularly with the government, around what is being termed opportunity youth. And these are youth who are neither in school or are working. They're youth that we have an opportunity to support at a national level as well as at a state level. They have an impact on the economy with respect to about $4.7 trillion nationally. And we're starting to take a look at what is the impact of not having youth or young people engaged in either school or work in the state of Oregon, and what could be the return if indeed we did support those young people with those particular two endeavors. So the council is looking at this across systems and taking a look at how we might better support this particular group of young people. I don't continue on, of young people. So part of what we're doing to do that is to basically get out, talk to communities, talk to the young people themselves, and come back with a report to the legislature on what we find. So I'll stop there if you have any questions.
Questions from Spell. Okay.
Oh.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Before you all leave, Rob, there's one part in here I know is important to your team, and that's the kindergarten assessment mm-hmm. process. Could you speak to that, why it's significant, sort of, you know, why we should care, kind of a
question? Certainly, yes. So this fall, for the first time, all kindergartners in public school across the state have been involved in the kindergarten assessment. We used to call it the kindergarten readiness assessment, but it made people nervous about it. Does it mean if they're not ready, they don't get to go to kindergarten? And so it's the kindergarten assessment is what we're calling it now. And that assessment is really looks at very early literacy and numeracy skills as students arrive at kindergarten that would determine if they're ready to learn at the kinder level. Kindergarten teachers are giving that assessment to students. It takes about 15 to 18 minutes per engagement because it's a very one-on-one kind of engagement. They're looking at, you know, identification of numbers, counting skills, letters, letter sounds, a little phonemic segmentation. So can you put a couple sounds together? And that kind of thing to determine where that child sits and what kind of experience, what we want to be able to know from this is what kind of experience has the student had or the child had prior to arrival in kindergarten, and what can we learn about that so that we can identify those practices that give us the best, most likely, the best likelihood that that student is going to be ready for kindergarten, and then can we start to replicate some of those experiences over time. The other piece of it is knowing, having the kindergarten teacher know where that student is currently so they can think about what kind of instruction they can begin to implement on that individual basis and collectively for their class, moving that child forward. So here's where we are today. What's happened previously? Here's where we are today. How do we move that student forward over time? And so that's underway. I've been out in schools, a number of schools and districts for the past couple of weeks since school started. Probably one of the richest exchanges I had was all the kindergarten teachers in the Klamath City schools together with me in a room telling me about their experience with the kinder assessment, talking about its value, some things that might be done better, and some things that they might do better in its implementation. And so it was really valuable. We're going to be asking questions at the end of the assessment, which will be completed over about 6 weeks. And I talked about the academic piece. What I didn't talk was kind of about the behavioral piece. So the other part of that is an observation of the teacher of those kinders over the first 6 weeks of school about what they look like, how they engage, how they interact with other students, what they know or don't know about how to do school, basically, for kinder readiness. And that's the part that takes a little more time for the teacher to fill that out so that we have not just sort of their academic skill set, but a little bit about their behavioral skill set as well, that goes together to talk about kindergarten readiness.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And I confess I might have had some personal interest in this. We have a a young man who's our son who went through that test a couple weeks ago. I asked him how it went, and he said it went pretty well. I don't want to talk about it.
My only suggestion, Chair Hass, is that you not accept that that explanation about school henceforth.
Yes.
I understand. Yeah.
It really is amazing, you know. Our daughter went to a half-day kindergarten, you know, 10 years ago. It's one of the reasons I got involved in the full-day kindergarten saga. But it was not even half-day, as you know. It was maybe 2 hours of carpet squares and sing-alongs. And the other night, you know, fast forward 10 years, we went to this new kindergarten with full day. We still have to pay for the second half, but set and structure, reading problems, math, it was a lot like school.
Yes,
and
sir.
I think that's a huge leap forward, done without a lot of fanfare, but standards are improving.
Yeah. Definitely. Thank
okay,
you.
So we have the next panel here on these 3,200 bills.
Thank you, Chair Hass, members of the committee. Can we start? Sorry. Again, for the record, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm joined here today by my colleagues, Whitney Grubb and Hilda Roselli, and they're going to talk a little bit about some of the investments that we are making in students in the state of Oregon. I want to talk just real briefly about Oregon Department of Education's piece of that and then turn it over to them where they can get into the detail of actually what's being delivered. And we talk sometimes with the OEIB and ODE about the what and the how. And I think that this presentation will be a really nice explanation of that. And so hopefully what's been passed out to you is a document that lays out all of the different investments that we have under House Bill 3233, the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, and then the investments under House Bill 3232, the Strategic Initiatives for Student Success. Representative Johnson talked in our last session just a little bit about, you know, wow, these things are coming out to school districts very quickly, and there's a lot of it. It really was an interesting discussion that we entered into last spring when we recognized that we felt like these investments were going to get support and funding, and we needed to be prepared, and we needed it to be in a way where school districts could respond to RFPs and also could other providers, some of our nonprofit groups and colleges and other partners, could respond in a reasonable fashion. And so we talked about what would we put out first. We need to bring together a group, talk about what is it that we're hoping to accomplish, what are some of our expectations, and how would we move this out so that we ensure that the very most important investments and the dollars are in the hands of school districts and other providers at the appropriate time and, again, as quickly as possible, and yet not overwhelm them or our system of delivery. And so we put together basically the chart that sits in front of you, and what you'll see is what the initiative is, the total number of dollars, and then there's a column that says round, and it says round one, round two, and round three. Sometimes it says round one and two. And really that was when we were going to get these things out. And so I would direct your attention to the page that's titled House Bill 3233, and the very top one, mentoring for first and second year teachers. Well, our teachers are there and they're teaching, and we wanted to make sure that those teachers had mentors absolutely as quickly as possible. And so this was a round one, and we got that out to school districts in an RFP. They responded. We went through the selection. The dollars are on the way out the door, and districts have new first and second year teachers and administrators, and they're hiring up those mentors and or have hired up those mentors already so that we get our new educators the very best experience that they can, and that their engagement with students is as positive as possible over time. So some of these, because they say round one and two, there were some groups that stood at the ready. They were ready to go right now with delivery. And so when I look, for example, at Common Core implementation, there were some districts that they've got that process ready to go. They want those dollars, and so that's in round one. And then we also wanted to put some out in round two for groups who took a little bit longer time to get their applications in place. So we wanted to have a couple rounds with that. We began letting the RFPs on these really between now and it was September 1st, and we expect to have half of the dollars available for this first year. So we split it into a 49% in the first year, more or less, and 51% of the funds in the second year. And 51.5% of the funds should be in the hands of providers by October 15th that were available for this first year. And then round $2 will go out in mid-December, and round three, they'll be out in February in anticipation of the hiring season and summer if we're looking at extended school years and the like. And so this has been a quick process for us. I'm really pleased with OEIB was extremely helpful in the work that we did, and certainly central to thinking about how to do this, the work that Whitney and Hilda have done to support us in the effort. And our procurement department and our contracts people have been burning the midnight oil, and I'm very pleased at the work that they've done so that we can begin to see these investments pay off. With that, I'd answer any questions, or I certainly would turn it over to my colleagues.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Thank you, Rob. I appreciate that. But you know, part of the urgency is not just that the system's ready out there for the investment, but we have policies in place that require the timely investment, particularly on the 290 implementation. You know, we've got to get those resources out there because the evaluation systems are there now. You know, the educator evaluations are all happening according to the new systems that the districts have up and running. So it's essential we have those tools out there to provide the professional development as those needs are identified in those teachers. So I recognize it creates a little angst at the local level to have to quickly man up and engage in a process they haven't previously. But it is timely and it's important, so I appreciate what you're doing.
Chair Hass, Representative Johnson, thank you. Precisely correct. And you'll see that that one is around one and
exactly.
Two, so that we can make sure that those who are ready get it right now, and those who need a little bit of time, even though they really shouldn't, right. Get it when they can use it. Thank you.
And Rep. Johnson, you did sound like a school board member.
Yes, absolutely.
And Whitney, he did say man up.
So Whitney, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Chair Hass, members of the committee, Whitney Grubbs, policy advisor for the OEIB. And I have brought much more material than we have time to go over today, but it will be there for you when you want to refer back to it, copies of this slideshow, similar to the chart you have in front of you, kind of explains more in detail about what each of the investments are. But I'd like to just use our short time together to talk a little bit more about the why on the strategic investments. As you know, the legislature at the recommendation of the OEIB invested in House Bill 3232, which we call our strategic investments in students. And these investments really are designed to do a couple of things. And the first thing, most important thing, is that these investments were recommended after a review of evidence and a lot of process and looking at what best practices are and how we can really transform outcomes for students. And these investments are designed to create real rapid improvement in some of the key outcomes that we want to see for students. Those outcomes like ready for kindergarten, arriving at kindergarten ready. By the way, Chair Hass, my daughter also took the kindergarten assessment this year, so we share that in common. But that outcome, third grade reading, which we know is a very key indicator. If students aren't reading at grade level by third grade, it's hard for them to be on track for the rest of their school career. And so these investments were really designed to cluster around those key outcomes and to create some rapid improvement. They are not investments that will be spread evenly across the state, but they are investments that are really meant to go where we think they can be best used. And so we've created some criteria to look at that are, some of them are in the statute. I'll have you skip to the next page. So these are the criteria that are in the statute, and they largely mirror what OEIB and ODE have been thinking about and working together on as we do the technical implementation piece. These investments are really aimed at advancing 40-40-20. In all things, we're really looking at if we're closing the achievement gap and how we can do that. We are trying to use these investments to steer folks toward collaborating, so bringing together partners that might not otherwise be working together. These investments are aimed at really helping support and engage parents and families. It's especially critical around the early literacy pieces, where we know that educators can't do it alone, and many times it's natural that we really lean on parents, families, and support them in the early literacy ventures. And these are all investments that are really based on evidence and best practice. And so with that, I'll just really quickly talk about the three different sets of investments and then leave it to you to have more deeper information. So the first one, let's skip this one and go. There we go. So the early Oregon early literacy investment of $8.2 million is being used for a couple different things. Through the Department of Ed, we are expanding the response to intervention program, which is a very successful method of offering support and intervention to young readers the moment they begin to struggle. And also, this investment will provide some additional support to our focus and priority schools, which were the schools designated through our waiver process last year as ones that are most struggling. And so this will provide them some grants to help implement the literacy portions of their improvement plans. The Early Learning Council will also engage in process of putting out some RFPs around engaging and supporting parents and early care providers in early literacy, some expansion of access to libraries and books and resources, which I think is critically important, and the libraries have proven to be a really exciting and innovative partner for communities in terms of literacy. And then a small $200,000 to OEIB for a statewide reading campaign that's aimed to really build excitement in local communities around literacy. You can go ahead and... let's skip to the next one. The second investment is guidance and support for post-secondary aspirations, $7.4 million. This included the continuation of the Aspire program in OSAC that many of you know about, that's really aimed at mentoring and support for students to get them to post-secondary. We are also using $3 million for expansion, especially for underserved students, of access to dual credit, AP and IP exams, and other college bearing credit opportunities for underserved students. And then a grant program that Rob's shop will put together around monitoring and supporting students to ensure they're on track as they transition into middle school and into high school. So that whole kind of middle years, making sure that our students are on track and given support the moment that it appears they are falling behind. You got my pattern down, Hilda. Thank you. And the final investment is broad. It's connecting to the world of work. I think it's one of the most exciting pieces of this. There is an investment around STEM. It is, I think, a small investment, but one that is in a long time coming, and that's really to build across the state some examples of what a STEM lab network could look like. So really providing communities that are doing a lot of thinking and work around connecting education to their economy and workforce, and engaging students even from the early grades in real hands-on, innovative and exciting opportunities in STEM. This will allow us to provide some funding. This particular investment, the new House Bill 2636 last session created a STEM Council. They will work with us on thinking about the power of this investment and how it fits into a state plan for STEM. And this one also includes some money to continue and also to replicate the Eastern Promise program in Eastern Oregon, which is an innovative and really exciting example of what happens when you take community college, high schools, and university and put them all together and really talking about what it means to move students across the pathway and what it means for students to be proficient. So these are the three buckets of work, and as I said, there's a lot more detail in front of you in what you received from me and Rob. But I'll pause for questions, and I'll let Hilda get into the teacher network, which is really exciting. So, Senator Haas and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be able to update you a little on the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. And as Rob pointed out, these strategic investments really are an opportunity for us to consider what our educators are dealing with right now. And as you are aware, this is a time in which they are facing new performance systems that they need to work together to create. They also are working on decreasing achievement gaps that are increasing and more important than ever around our historically underrepresented populations. They are now facing the use and implementation of standards that have the highest level of thinking skills and in-depth kinds of engagement of curriculum and resources that all of our students must have to meet the Common Core State Standards. They're also needing to think about ways in which they are engaging their performance in continually reviewing, looking at student performance, and being able to use that information in ways to collaborate with other educators to improve performance. So one of the slides that I like to reference is the fact that all of these skills that we're asking of educators have direct direct touching points with metrics that we've identified as key throughout this continuum of our pre-K through moving into post-secondary education. So if you think about it, whether it's a reading specialist, an early learning provider, a special educator, somebody who is teaching the Common Core skills, or somebody who is looking at those STEM supports for students, all the way along, we know that their behaviors and their actions are what make a key difference for our students and their attainment of success in education. So with the development of the House Bill 3233, we have three major purposes. And one is we understood from talking with educators that there is a great need to create a sense of shared responsibility. It is not any one group's responsibility to put all of this together. And what we wanted to create was a culture that shared that responsibility not just across educators, teachers, and administrators in the K-12 system. We wanted to open that to incorporate and bring in those educators who are in the pipeline to become the next workforce, as well as our partners in post-secondary education, both community colleges and four-year institutions. Secondly, we already knew and had evidence from some initiatives that had been in place, for example, the Oregon Mentor Project. We knew that there was success in many of these initiatives, and we needed to build upon that and to pull out of that the best practices that could be shared with others. And then lastly, as I mentioned, this is a time in which we needed to think about the recruitment and preparation and the career advancement opportunities of our educators. We're looking at really a continuum. This chevron design kind of gives you a way to think about how the funds are distributed right now. This does include the costs around ODE staffing and the infrastructure, but this is basically how those funds are in design to impact all the way along a continuum of an educator's profession, all the way from starting from thinking about that next group of educators, whether they be career changers, employees within the school district, or individuals who are in traditional middle school, high school programs and thinking about becoming educators.
So one of the things that we also were challenged with is thinking about a state. And as we've mentioned here, you know, that originally I think there had been some discussion about bricks and mortar. Is this a center concept? And instead, we have embraced what we consider a more of a virtual network of creating access for professionals no matter where they're employed, but also building upon the strengths of programs and initiatives that already have a lot to share with others. And with that comes the idea of thinking about the fact that professional development models themselves are changing. So we want to stimulate those kinds of designs that are going way past the idea of a one-day workshop where you go and you get great ideas and you go back and there's no one to talk to about it, there's no collaboration, and there's no follow-up. So that is a way that we are hoping to engage educators across the continuum. Also, it's very important that every one of these investments come back with results and a measure of looking at how we know that this is making a difference. And so we've provided you with a number of slides that you can look at your leisure around looking at the outcome metrics that we're going to be using, and including one that is relatively new for Oregon that will engage us in looking at some of the conditions of our teaching profession and give us some baseline information. This has been used in 9 different states, and it is really engaging all of us in thinking about what are the baseline conditions that educators are working in and how do they see the needs and supports that are either there or not there. This will guide our continued investments, honing in the kinds of strategies that make a difference. As Ron already mentioned, we have a wonderful opportunity to expand our funding for our mentoring program. I'm delighted to say that we're looking at 75 districts this year that will be receiving funds in year one. And that also includes over 1,300 new teachers and well over 130 administrators as well, brand new administrators. And when we think about that, that's a significant impact on all of the educators who we know are starting out with a great desire to be successful. We also mentioned, as Representative Johnson referenced, the importance of implementing Senate Bill 290 and making sure that those strategies that are going to engage educators in developing an understanding around evaluation and effectiveness systems that can build in continuous improvement must hit the ground running immediately. And so you have already heard a little bit about that initiative. In addition, we were able to look at ways to expand the success of district collaboration grants that engaged educators in working together and thinking about career pathways that would enable more teachers to assume roles as leaders. When I talked to a number of different groups, one of the things I heard was there's a lot to be done. It can't all be done by a principal at a site. This has to be a shared responsibility, and this enables educators to work together with the administrators in their schools and districts to assume more of those roles and develop professional development opportunities for their colleagues. Again, the distribution of that is coming out any day now, and it also is showing that we have a very good geographic distribution of those funds with priority focus schools as well as schools that are more remote from others. There's been a wonderful response from consortiums that have written to these proposals, and we will continue to encourage that. I'll skip through some of these, but I do want to mention educator preparation. We know that this is a vital piece that must go hand in hand with the improvements that we make in our educator workforce so that we don't prepare the next generation of educators and then have to retool all of those individuals when they enter. We also know that there's a wonderful capacity when you engage the higher ed partners working together with the K-12 system. And so I'm delighted that we are able to build upon the success of some design grants that took place last year with 5 different partners. partnerships, and we are able to fund two additional partnerships that engage multiple universities, community colleges, ESDs, and school districts. And we will be looking at the results of those best practices around four major areas. Recruitment of educators, how do we know the best means of identifying and selecting candidates into those programs, preparing them in robust clinical partnership experiences, and elevating the role of the teacher who's charged with guiding that new student teacher. And then lastly, really looking at how we can use that information to improve policies and practices. So I'm very excited that that work is just getting ready to be launched and will make a huge difference. I'm going to leave some of the rest of these for you to look at, but I'm very thrilled that we have been able to work together to increase the visibility and leadership of the department to reach out to our students and districts and families around particularly the needs of our growing numbers of students who are English language learners. And I think this capacity begins to close that achievement gap, but also one of the things that is happening is that it's happening at the same time that we have a great need to relate to families. What are these Common Core standards around? So this is a combination of where we're seeing some ways to integrate these investments and be able to look at those outcomes both separately and integrated, which you will be hearing back from us every time we come back to report. So thank you, and appreciate the opportunity to provide you with more information that you can look at later.
Thank you, Hilda. Appreciate that. Questions? Okay. Thank you. We will stay tuned. Thank you. All right. And we will conclude today by Teach Oregon, Preparing the Next Generation of Diverse and Effective Oregon Teachers. Administrator Donovan, can you summarize what's coming up here?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Teach Oregon has been running a mentorship program that kind of dovetails off of some of the initiatives that we heard about earlier in the committee hearing. And a couple of, we're going to have two presenters today, Ms. Mary Cadiz and Ms. Kristen Dixon, who are going to talk about the projects they've been undertaking.
Welcome. Chair Haas and members of the committee, thank you for including us on the agenda today. I'm Mary Cadiz. I'm directing the Teach Oregon project for Chalkboard, and we'll be working closely with the group that Hilda mentioned with the funding through House Bill 3233 on a couple of the projects. We're going to have all those five projects working together. Today I'm joined by Dr. Kristen Dixon, and she is the dean of the School of Counseling and Education at Corbin University and is very involved in the Salem-Keizer Collaborative. So thank you again for asking for an update on Teach Oregon. And I'm just going to quickly give you a little history, and you heard Hilda mention some of the key factors of this model, but in 2011, a team from Chalkboard researched teacher preparation research throughout the country, looked at, just got a great overview of all of the research and the different projects that were being done throughout the country, and decided that it had potential for Oregon, and so began that process of putting together a request for proposals and got those out. And what they said was, if you want to apply for these funds, you have to do it in a collaborative manner. And that involves districts, K-12 districts. And one of the districts has to have been part of the class project, so they understand the design model that Chalkboard prefers to use. And then one university partner would have to be NCATE approved, have an NCATE approved program. And so those were the requirements that were put on the groups. And you can see in this particular slide, the professional development, performance evaluation, career pathways, and compensation were all part of the class model, which you've heard quite a bit about, that was used to develop teacher evaluation. The other ones that are in orange are the ones that are key to the Teach Oregon or the teacher preparation project that we're embarking upon now. Career pathways is highlighted in green because it was a big driver toward a lot of the work around teacher preparation. So why Teach Oregon? Well, there's some things that you're well acquainted with that you've heard from numerous people. We need that factor of high-quality instruction and teaching to meet our 40-40-20 goal. We have a need to continue to close the achievement gap. We all know that. We have a projected need to hire 16,400 new teachers in the next 7 years, and that's replacements for those who will be retiring and some growth factor built in. We also have a goal of creating a more diverse and talented workforce that mirrors our student population. Currently, we have 34% of our students of color, and only about 8% of our teachers are of color. Another big factor that hits us in the budget area is turnover costs associated with retention. Currently, that's about a $45 million bill for our schools because in many districts we're losing about 40% of our new teachers in the first 5 years. The other thing is we need to provide our teacher candidates with extended experiences in our high-impact schools. That's part of the reason we're losing some of them. And then, of course, you've all been aware of the national research reports and media coverage that substantiate the value of educator effectiveness, and so that's a big part of this. When Chalkboard put out the call, five consortiums answered, one that was a combination of the Central Oregon area and the Willamette Valley and with OSU as their partner. There was PAC-7, which is the group of smaller districts out just west. The Portland Metro, which was Portland State with three metro school districts. Salem-Keizer, which was one district with three universities. And then Springfield, which all of these groups submitted proposals under the partnership, and those went in the first of June, and during June and July those were all read, reviewed, ranked by several committees and groups that and that effort was led by Dr. Golden and Nancy Golden. Again, the five design team partnerships were asked to use the four blueprints in designing and planning their proposed projects for Teach Oregon. And Teach Oregon, during this last year, provided all teams with some research dollars and design dollars at the level of $36,000 for each group. And they brought large teams and, again, used that whole idea of Chalkboard of giving full voice to teachers and the other folks affected by these proposals, and so they spent a year working with assistance from Chalkboard. The projects that have been funded for implementation, you see the three that were funded by Chalkboard at about a level of $230,000 for each year for 3 years. Portland Metro, you can see the partners there, Salem and Springfield Immersion. And then after the proposals were read, it was recognized that the PAC-7 proposal and the Central Oregon Consortium proposal had some significant ideas and had merit. And so there were discussions that began about looking at these to fund under the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. And it's been determined that that's what will happen. But all five projects will network and work together. And that's important because these are the deliverables we're expecting out of these projects. We expect that we can demonstrate a positive impact on student achievement, that we will be able to increase the number of talented and diverse teachers in the workforce, that we'll increase the retention both of teacher candidates, you might have heard that term before, as student teachers, and active teachers by providing early experiences, extended residency, having them in the schools, actually in the classroom for longer periods of time, and also training the cooperating teacher or clinical teacher who works with them. And then you've heard the team from ODE talk about the mentor support and induction. And the good news is many of the groups that are involved in Teach Oregon did submit for mentor project funds and are doing that also in a collaborative way. Another deliverable is we'll increase the collaboration time between university supervisors and K-12 staff and administrators and give them time to plan and work together to refine their work and be more on target and laser focused on what they're doing. We're also going to improve the incentives for cooperating or clinical teachers working with teacher candidates. We're going to take more of their time working with those candidates and working with the university teams. And so that's another part of common ground in all of these projects.
What will the incentives be?
The incentives currently, Chair Haas, are typically vouchers for credit from the public universities or small stipends. And so there's been some review of what those are going to be. There also is talk about access to university resources and those sorts of things that aren't necessarily connected to dollars. They do have a dollar behind them, but not a payout to the teacher. But those are the kind of incentives that are being looked at. We also hope to get a clear process in place so that as we discover things in the residency experience, that can be shared with the faculty at the university, and either changes made in syllabi or changes made on the experience side. And so we think that will have a great impact on the joint work that's being done. And lastly, at the conclusion of the project, somewhere in the future, and hopefully as we progress along, we'll be able to provide data and evaluative information that will identify some exemplars, and will also provide some future recommendations for teacher preparation in Oregon. And, you know, currently we have 20 teacher preparation programs, so we have quite a few involved, and as I mentioned, many of these are NCATE-approved or CAPE-approved programs that we're working with through this project. Do you have any questions?
Questions?
If not, I've asked Kristen to come and give her perspective from a dean's point of view. In working with Salem Kaiser, she's watched 1 year of trained clinical teachers working with student teachers or teacher candidates, and now they're into their second year. Kristen?
Thank you. Chair Haas and members of the Senate Education Committee, thank you. I've only been a dean since July 1st.
Start off with your name and ID.
Oh, Kristen Dixon, Corbin University, Dean of the School of Education and Counseling. I've only been in my position since July 1st, but I've been in teacher education for the past 11 years. And one of the things that I noticed coming from a background of teaching in a K-12 setting, and as I moved into the teacher education field, was how would I stay current with what's happening? And how would I train teachers, new teachers, to be as effective as possible from day one? The Salem-Kaiser Collaborative, which has been funded by Teach Oregon, I think is a unique answer to that question. It's unique to have three institutions of higher ed collaborating rather than competing. It's unique to sit down with deans and faculty from Willamette University, Western Oregon University, and Corbin University, as well as Salem-Kaiser district personnel, principals, cooperating teachers, and talk about current trends, how our teacher candidates are doing in the classroom. By classroom, I mean the K-12 experience. What can we do back at our independent campuses to strengthen their abilities? So in and of itself, I think that's quite a unique and powerful model. It's the bridge that connects our students in higher ed from the theory that they learn to the practice that they're going to practice when they walk into those K-12 experiences. For me at Corbin, it has meant looking at our faculty and their FTE load a little bit differently, giving them opportunity and time to spend in a local school. I have several faculty members who are assigned a particular school. They go every week. They spend all morning or all afternoon in a multitude of classrooms, working with teacher candidates, working with clinical teachers. They're invited to back-to-school night. So really what you have is a trio, a university faculty member, a clinical teacher, and a teacher candidate working together to help that teacher candidate grow and to provide opportunities for all three for professional development. One of the initiatives that the Salem-Kaiser Collaborative has started is called the Clinical Teacher Academy. When a clinical teacher is selected, we meet with them for a full week. We being, again, university personnel from each institution, Salem-Kaiser personnel, and the clinical teachers. And we talk about the developmental continuum of a new teacher, not even a new teacher yet, but a soon-to-be teacher, a pre-service teacher, and what they can do to partner with us and what we can do to partner with them so that after 6 months or a year in the classroom, they are truly ready to have their own classroom. We've extended the length of their practicum experiences from one semester to two semesters oftentimes. We've tried to increase the opportunities that they have to work with diverse students. We're working on some collaborative research projects together, providing technology in one case in a classroom and working with cooperating teachers to use that technology. At times, we're swapping. University faculty will teach a morning while a cooperating teacher or clinical teacher comes out to the university and teaches a classroom management course or an assessment course for the day. So again, it's bridging that, maybe gap isn't the right word, but providing that bridge for that teacher candidate to see the university personnel, school district personnel work together for their benefit. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you for that and for your work. Questions?
No, no questions. I'm impressed.
Well, this is good, ambitious. Right. We thank you for hanging in with us today and very much appreciate the support of the Chalkboard Project as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your support for the network. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, gents. Another day, another dollar.
Another day, another dollar.
With no other business before us, the Senate Committee on Education Workforce Development is adjourned.